You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Friday, January 15th, 2021. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. It's Casual Friday, folks. I'm wearing my soft-collared shirt, as is the tradition on Fridays. Joining us today, New Republic writer Osita Wadnevu. Also on the program today, Biden introduces a $1.9 trillion COVID relief package. And as we face a bonfire of COVID infections, health officials estimate that one in three people in L.A. County are infected. Meanwhile, federal prosecutors claim that the Capitol insurrectionists meant to capture and assassinate lawmakers. The DOJ Inspector General finds that good old Jeff Sessions was the driving force behind the immigrant kidnapping policy. The longtime Republican Congressman and Senator Jeff Sessions. Another Democratic lawmaker tests positive after that Capitol Hill lockdown where Republican lawmakers refused to wear masks. Odd that none of the Republicans caught it, or maybe they're just not going public about it. Meanwhile, Donald Trump at 38% approval rating. Not only has he been impeached twice now, setting a record, but it is capping an average approval rating lower than any president in the history of polling. And as reported by the American Prospect, Jamie Harrison to chair the DNC. Meanwhile, Biden vows resources for state parties. And lastly, because why not, Donald Trump administration trying to term limit federal scientists on the way out the door. All this and more on today's Majority Report, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome, as usual, joining me today, Emma Viglin. Emma, how are you, Emma?
I'm well. I'm looking forward to the weekend. It's going to be nice to relax.
That's right. We will actually have a long weekend of sorts. We will be here on Monday talking to Professor Gerald Horn about Martin Luther King and the way that we celebrate him today, and perhaps some of the reasons behind the way that we do, as opposed to maybe a clear reflection on who he was. We will talk more about that on Monday. A lot of things to get to today. We are, of course, awaiting more information as to when the Senate will take up the impeachment hearings, but presumably now it is clear that it is probably going to be under the leadership of Chuck Schumer as opposed to Mitch McConnell. There has been a lot of test ballooning, a lot of a sense of, you know, where will we get if we're where will we be in the context of the Republican Party if we were actually to in some way say, hey, maybe we should discourage people from armed attacks on our lawmakers and threats to hang them. That might have a disadvantaging effect on our democracy and the way that things function regardless of what our politics or ideology are in that moment. I mean, I know there
is... Hot take, Sam.
Yeah, that's a very... I'm really going out on a limb there. But apparently it is, you know, something of concern to Republican lawmakers. Now, I'm not sure... First off, if I was to believe... There's a couple of different sort of narratives that we're starting to see now as some form of justification for the way that the Republican lawmakers are acting or the way that this mob did. But if I'm a Republican lawmaker who's genuinely afraid for my physical well-being, if I vote for impeachment, it seems to me I would also be a little bit concerned of my physical well-being if I do not in some way say we should not be inciting people to commit this type of violence. The other take I'm hearing is we need to have more understanding for why people decided to take bats, take sticks, take a fire extinguisher, maybe beat someone to death, smash up things in the Capitol building.
It's interesting.
Build a gallows.
Yeah, like we already know the reason. We already do understand why they were driven to this, and that's the exact reason we draw the conclusion that justice needs to be served for the people that incited this. We already have that understanding. So imagine if, again, these were Muslim people. I know this is a trite point, but I think it's an important one. This would be called allowing the terrorists to win. Oh, you're gonna back down just because you want healing or you want this to be over? That would be weakness as defined by the Republican Party, but they're white right wingers, so it doesn't matter.
Indeed. Well, I think Osito's been writing quite a bit about these type of questions, and we will be talking to him in a moment. In the meantime, here is Joe Biden summarizing some of the top line items in this $1.9 trillion COVID relief bill. And this is a pretty decent bill. The question is, you know, where is it going to end up in? Let's hear this and then we'll address some of the questions about it.
And we will be responsible with taxpayers' dollars, ensuring accountability that reduces waste and fraud and abuse like we did in the Recovery Act that I administered in our administration. Direct cash payments, extended unemployment insurance, rent relief, food assistance, keeping essential frontline workers on the job, aid to small businesses. These are the key elements to the American Rescue Plan that would lift 12 million Americans out of poverty and cut child poverty in half. That's 5 million children lifted out of poverty if we move. Our plan would reduce poverty in the black community by one-third, reduce poverty in the Hispanic community by almost 40%, and includes much more, like an increase in the minimum wage to at least $15 an hour. People tell me that's going to be hard to pass. Florida just passed it. As divided as that state is, they just passed it. The rest of the country is ready to move as well. It should be a national minimum wage of $15 an hour. No one working 40 hours a week should live below the poverty line. That's what it means. If you work for less than $15 an hour and work 40 hours a week, you're living in poverty. It includes access to affordable child care that will enable parents, particularly women, to get back to work. I look forward to working with members of Congress of both parties to move quickly to get the American Rescue Plan to the American people. Then we can move with equal urgency and bipartisanship to my Build Back Better recovery plan that I will call for next month to generate even more economic growth.
We will get more into the details of this plan over the course of the next week or two. One of the top line, I guess, controversies, at least on the left, is that he had said $2,000. In fact, what is in the bill is the difference between the first bill that was passed at the end of this last congressional session, $600, and $1,400. I I mean, I understand the point, and I think from a rhetorical standpoint, been a lot better sell to just continue on with 2000. You had already done that. With that said, one thing that is an expansion that was not clear in the first round of COVID relief, or I should say the last one, was that there are about almost 14 million adult dependents, half of whom are students, 20-some-odd percent are folks with disabilities. Not sure what makes up the other 25%. I think it's, you know, a much smaller cohorts of people. But those people were not eligible for the $600 payments. And my understanding is now they are going to be eligible for at least $1,400 of those payments. You're talking 13.5 million people. That's, you know, another $200 billion. I think that more or less it's going out the door. And
yeah, that's huge.
That's helpful. I can see the points on the 2000, but there's a lot of enhancement to unemployment insurance, which is hugely important. These are folks who have lost, who have definitively lost their means of being able to make money, and an extra $400 on top of any type of state benefits they would get is crucial, and that goes till September.
It's and also the eviction moratorium extends till September too.
The eviction moratorium through September. I believe there's significant rental support in terms of money. We got to dig through more of this, and we will talk more about it next week. But the real question is going to be, ultimately, is how this thing gets passed, because how this thing gets passed is going to dictate how much of what is laid out by Joe Biden is there at the end of this process. And that's going to be crucial. I find it very hard to believe that you're going to get, there's a couple of different theories, but I find it very hard to believe that you're going to get over 15 senators, I think, Republican senators. Maybe I think we're up at or even 10 for that matter, to pass this bill. But, which is what you're going to need, assuming you hold all the Democrats. However, there are some people who are suggesting that this is basically Biden's way to find out what Republican senators are amenable to certain aspects of this bill, and then roll that bill out as a separate bill.
Right.
Pass that, and then take what's left over and run that through reconciliation.
Which is why Chuck Schumer is apparently pushed Biden to go a little bit bigger. You see the results of this there. The point about the $2,000 checks is I'm more critical of Biden than maybe you are here, because nobody knows the semantics of, oh, you know, you got the $600 and we're going to make up the difference with $1,400. He made a point to say $2,000 checks. That paints Democrats into a corner, and people may not realize that he was kind of weaseling his way around that in the initial in the Georgia race. So I think it could hurt Democrats at least marginally.
We'll see. All right. We'll take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Osita Wivnevo in just a moment. Folks, this program today is sponsored by one of my favorite sponsors. I use their product multiple times a week. It is Sunset Lake CBD at sunsetlakecbd.com. These guys started out, they were a dairy farm that was providing dairy for Ben and Jerry's. They still do that, but some of them branched off, and they started growing hemp a couple years ago. They have great business practices, minimum wage, $15 for everybody who works there. The company is mostly employee-owned. They work with the University of Vermont to practice regenerative agriculture practices, pesticide-free hemp, organic fertilizer hemp. Their practices, both from a business and from an agriculture perspective, are impeccable. On top of that, and perhaps, I don't know if it's more important, but equally important, is that their product is excellent. I'm a big user of the CBD tincture. It helps me go to sleep. I guess, I mean, there's been a couple of times where things have been particularly stressful during this time where I will also take a little a needle drop, but also gummy bears they have, CBD gummy bears, which I tend to stay
those
away.
Those are my favorites.
They taste so good, but I have a sweet tooth, so I can't start on that, or I'll eat the entire thing, and then I'll just be I'll be a little bit
zoned
out. I
need to limit myself, but I do. It's good. It's like a little sour, too. Just totally works for me.
Gummy bears are very tasty, actually.
Yeah.
Maybe a little bit too tasty. Also, I've been using heavily Anarka? How do I say that? I don't know. It's CBD. It's a salve with Anarka.
Arnica.
Thank you. And the salve is fantastic. I use it for my eczema, but also it's, you know, for achy muscles. And they have CBD-infused coffee, which is delicious. That's my weekend brew. And Matt is a big advocate of the smokes, although I have to admit I've been smoking some of those pre-rolls on occasion and enjoying it. Matt, what's your experience with the smokables?
People want to check out the smalls. It's an interesting little product where it's already removed from the stem, so you just insert it right in your grinder. Easy to grind up little nugs, so check out the smalls, folks.
Folks, head over to sunsetlakecbd.com and use the coupon code LEFTISBEST. One word, LEFTISBEST, you get 20% off. They're fans of the show. They wanted their coupon code to be LEFTISBEST. I was like, great, that's a great idea. LEFTISBEST, 20% off. Check it out, sunsetlakecbd.com. You will not be, you will not regret that you did, sunsetlakecbd.com. Also, today's program brought to you by Blinkist. Blinkist is an easy way for you to sit down, or I should say an easy way for you not to have to sit down and learn something. It's for anyone who cares about learning but doesn't have a lot of time. Blinkist takes the key ideas and insights from over 4,000 nonfiction bestsellers in over 27 categories, gathers them together in 15-minute text and audio explainer, or they call them blinks. And it allows you to get into a topic quickly. It allows you to get the main takeaways. It's basically just an invitation. Like, this is a book I want to invest some time in, so I'm going to go buy the full book. Blinkist has even teamed up with popular podcast creators to create blinks for those, too, so you can get to the heart of a podcast episode fast. 15 million people are already using Blinkist to broaden their knowledge in 27 nonfiction categories. They got self-improvement, they got management, they got mindfulness, and more. So basically what I do is I've lined a couple of these up on my app. And 8 days to unlocking language, right? So what they do is they have 8 blinks that you listen to. They're 15 minutes each, so I'm pretty sure I'm going to be able to do this in 4 days. And it basically just tells you the different books that will help you get a better understanding of language. Or you can do they have productivity classes, and they get a collection of 13 blinks. They've got just a whole wealth of these things that I'm like, I don't want to read I'm not going to read an entire book on how to make more friends. But I do feel like I should probably learn how to do that. And so to get it within 15 minutes, that's how much I'm going to dedicate for that project. You can use Blinkist Shortcast to quickly catch up on the podcast you missed. For me, also, this is an example of the other thing I use for Blinkist. Books out there I feel like maybe I should read, but I don't feel like I'm going to read, but I should know them enough so that if I'm in a situation, I might want to talk about
it. Cocktail party, you know, next year or whatever.
Just for instance, like Blowout by Rachel Maddow. Like, I'm not sure I'm going to get to that book, but it's a book I feel like maybe I should know about and be able to at least, you know, oh, nice to see you. Drink this, but you know, whatever it is.
Yeah.
But also, then there's things like Why We Sleep, which is a Blinkist where I was like, I'm actually genuinely curious about this, but I'm not that curious about it. Mm-hmm. So it's a great, you can listen to it, you can read it, 15 minutes, Blinkist. And right now, you can go to Blinkist.com/Majority Report, start your free 7-day trial, get 25% off of Blinkist Premium Membership. That's Blinkist, spelled BLINKIST, Blinkist.com/Majority Report. You get 25% off and a 7-day free trial, Blinkist.com/Majority Report. Check it out. All right. Real pleasure to welcome to the program a writer from The New Republic, Osita Wanevu. Osita, welcome to the program. I've been wanting to talk to you for a while, frankly. I think I had mentioned to you, like, maybe since almost a year ago, I think you had written something to the effect of, I can't read, but it was, oh, end the GOP, which I think is, that's worn well past year. But let's talk about it in the context of this week, because about a week ago or so ago, you were writing in anticipation of the importance of impeachment. Articulate for us why impeaching the Republican, or I should say the president, was important, but the broader implications of it.
Sure. So, I mean, I think that everybody can basically agree, every rational person can agree that Trump is culpable for what happened last week, that he deserves to be impeached. But as was the case, I think, for the first impeachment that happened, you know, I don't think that's really sufficient as an answer to the place the country is in right now. Trump, as again, I think rational people can understand, is the sort of symptom of larger problems. And one of the big problems we have is the fact that we have a Republican Party in this country that is intensely reactionary. It's only gotten worse, visibly worse, over the past 10 years. And that is accruing structural power within our institutions. It's getting more powerful in the Senate. We won the Senate in this election, but in terms of the way the population of this country is distributed, over time, more and more of the seats are going to be in control of a smaller and smaller share of the population. Obviously, we know that it has structural power with the Electoral College, and we know that they've worked in state legislators to redraw congressional districts, to redraw state legislative districts to entrench their candidates. So those are all really big problems that I don't think getting rid of Trump is going to really help us solve. So what we need in this country, from my perspective, is a campaign, I don't know if you want to call it a campaign or sort of an ethical mission, whatever you want to call it, to actually disempower the Republican Party. Because if we allow things to continue on their current trajectory, it's only get more powerful as a party, and it's going to be very, very hard for us to avoid more of what happened on Wednesday.
We just had a story today, you know, that Jeff Sessions was driving the family, they call it family separation policy. In my mind, it was just out and out kidnapping. But nevertheless, the point is that, you know, Jeff Sessions, median Republican, you know, senator, essentially, when he was there, it was not like, this guy's not some type of huge outlier. It's just that he saw an opportunity, I think, early on that Donald Trump was amenable to, you know, one of his pet projects. But this is not a guy who was in some way, you know, sort of perceived as some type of outlier in the Republican Party. I mean, to a large extent, the Republicans got what they wanted, which I think Grover Norquist had said, you know, just give us a live hand that can sign stuff. And that's what it was.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, if pick any Republican who's now sort of held as being a model moderate, somebody who's a real beacon of light and a true conscience in the Trump era, pick any one of those people and you can find a precedent for what Trump has become in their former actions. Take somebody like Mitt Romney, who ran in 2012 with Paul Ryan on a campaign that was premised in part on the idea that Obama was waging this grand war on religion and American values, you know, and they tried to otherize him and didn't explicitly buy into the birther stuff, but I think implicitly tried to tap into those same anxieties. Look at somebody like John, you know, the late John McCain, who ran with Sarah Palin, who was the Trump, I think, in basically every respect. You can go all the way back to Reagan. We could be sitting here talking for an hour about Ronald Reagan. But there was apparently some revelation last year that he, you know, had been engaged in very crude racism against Africans behind the scenes. So, you know, everybody in the Republican Party on one level or another is if not directly complicit, certainly responsible for doing things that created this current political moment that we're in. And I think people have to reckon with that seriously.
Well, Joe Biden, as the president-elect and will be president in just a few days, he seems to embody the exact antithesis of what you're talking about. I mean, just last week, he discussed how we need a strong opposition party. We need a strong Republican Party. And his whole campaign was predicated on the notion that Trump was this sort of outlier and that the fever would break. I mean, to borrow what was used during the Obama years, which he was obviously a part of. What does that say about the future of combating Republicanism when the leader of the Democratic Party seems to find Republicanism essential to governance?
Yeah, well, it says that we can't depend upon Joe Biden to lead the charge against the Republican Party. We probably can't depend upon the Democratic Party either. I know that there are people who have, you know, high hopes that there's going to be a gradual ideological transformation. But frankly, I think it's going to be up to activists, to people on the left, to really make the case to the American public that the Republican Party can't really be abided in its current form and with the amount of power it currently has. I don't think that you're going to see a lot of Democrats under the Biden administration say the things that ought to be said, say all the things that I've been saying today and in all of my writing. That's not what they're there to do, really. I think that the work is going to be public communication. It can't just be people on Twitter who know how bad the Republican Party is complaining about how bad the Republican Party is, right? There has to be some kind of breakthrough that we're making with the public, because actually, you know, this is, I think, a mistake people on the left tend to make. There's this assumption that bipartisanship and compromise are sort of values that are held by elites in American politics that are disconnected from what people out there in the country actually feel. But no, like, if you look at surveys, Democrats in particular genuinely value bipartisanship. They genuinely think compromise is a good idea because that's the only model of government that's ever been sort of sold to them. That's a model we've been operating under for the past 30, 40 years. And so somebody has to go out there and tell them the story of you know, what the Republican Party is and how we can do things differently. Somebody has to go out and tell them why the filibuster is bad and why the Senate is bad in its current design. But those aren't really things that we can depend on Democratic politicians who exist within the current system to do for us. That's something that the left has to engage in as a project on its own.
Well, see, now this is, I mean, and I couldn't agree with you more on that point. I have made that point over and over again, that in many respects, the you know, part of the problem is this desire for compromise that Democrats have. I'm talking, when I say Democrats, I'm talking about people who go and vote for Democrats in elections, versus people who go out and vote for Republicans in elections. Now, that's changed over the past five years, or even 10 years, even prior to Trump. There was beginning to, you could start to see in the polling a change. So there has been some of that has seeped out into the broader, but respond to this, which I think is also problematic. So back in the day, one of the problems to that, to that agenda, or to completing that agenda, was that the Beltway media, if you will, was completely, their both siderism was huge. Now, it's died down during the Trump administration, but I'm quite convinced it's going to return. But part of the problem is that it seems to me, and I hear that we can't rely on Joe Biden for this, but if the Democrats as the opposition party don't go, but aren't publicly calling out the Republicans for these type of things, it's impossible to imagine that this media is going to do it too, right? Like that was the value to me about impeachment in the first place. It was basically saying, hey, you know, we've been saying this is wrong and this is wrong, but now we're actually, this is really wrong. We're impeaching them. And then you saw the numbers follow that because the Democrats were showing, not telling. And then the media could respond with, like, they really think this is bad. I mean, how do we break that logjam without an oppositional party that is taking, I mean, because presumably, you know, a lot of these people that you're talking about perceive politics as something that happens over there with these two players. And it's like, how can you watch a basketball game, be rooting for your team to win, and your team is just going like, well, maybe we shouldn't run up the score. Let's keep this close.
Well, like, it's, you know, a loser's mentality. Like, I mean,
well, how do you deal with that?
Yeah, I mean, I think your point about the media is very important, obviously, because I don't think we can really depend on CNN and the other major outlets to deviate from this perspective either. The people who are sort of elevating Liz Cheney as the conscience of the nation right now, you know. Ultimately, I think that the answer, and maybe this isn't, you know, a real and satisfying answer, is like, the answer is like having 10 more majority reports, right? Like having more media outlets and having more ways to communicate with the public from our perspective that aren't filtered through a press that has a lot of reasons not to, you know, should have people break from the existing model of politics. That's the real answer. And so every time I hear that AOC or one of the progressives in Congress is doing something to communicate with, again, ordinary people, people who aren't as plugged into American politics, people who don't really know what's going on as much, I think we have to applaud that and say that there needs to be more of it, because that's ultimately the solution. I just don't think at this stage we can really believe that either, you know, the Democratic Party is an institution, or, you know, the major institutions within the press are going to do this work for us. You know, I just think that we have to sort of strike out on our own in every possible way.
And what are the way, I mean, aside from obviously, and I couldn't agree more on the 10 majority reports, I think, I mean, aside from that, like, I mean, what are there other institutions that, you look around that you think are particularly effective for something like that?
Well, I think, you know, the answer I always give about this is think about the conservative movement and what it's done over the past half century. It would have been very easy for conservatives to say after Barry Goldwater's loss in 1964, well, conservatism can't work in this country. There's not enough of a constituency for it in the general public. It's going to get beaten in every election. We just have to turn to something else. That's not what they did. They got a lot of money and spent, you know, the decades between Goldwater and Reagan, you know, establishing think tanks, establishing publications, establishing different groups that reached out to people in you know, suburbia and tried to get them to cotton to conservative ideology. And that was a, you know, multi-decade long process, but it got the goods. It did engender a change in the ideological makeup of the American electorate. And I think that's ultimately what the left has to do. People hear these kinds of conversations and think, well, that means we just need to start a new party, right? And that's what we need, a third party that's going to be left and we're going to run in elections. There are like 12 left-wing parties already in this country and nobody's ever heard of, right? Because that was the solution that they thought was going to do the thing as well. I think we have to think a little bit more, in a more sophisticated way about things. It has to be a movement that we're building with different kinds of institutions that are built to meet different kinds of needs. And a lot of those needs are not going to be electoral. They're not going to be about running this or that person in a primary race, although that's going to be very important. They're going to be, how can we go to places where the left is very weak right now, in rural America, in places that we think are, you know, sort of deep red conservative, and what can we do over time to get people reading some things that we think are going to be influential and that should inform the way they think about the economy? What can we do to get them think differently about issues that they believe are already familiar to them and sort of defamiliarize them and make them open to new thinking? That's a big kind of abstract project. And it's something that I think is going to take a really long time and development of all kinds of different bodies, groups, institutions.
How much do you think that's going to accelerate as a function of generational change? I mean, we are right on the cusp of a massive generational shift, it seems to me, particularly within the Democratic Party. I just remind people, you know, Nancy Pelosi has been the Democratic leader in the House for almost two decades now. And if not two decades, and during that time, I think there's been a half a dozen Republican leaders of the House in one form or another. I'm not talking necessarily Speaker of the House, but in terms of majority leaders, our president is, you know, well into his 70s. We're about to see a big generational switch from the boomers and I guess even the silent generation to the next powerhouse is going to jump over my generation right to the millennials. Just because of the sheer numbers of these people, and that generation seems to be far more open to an understanding of politics as more combative, and B, an understanding of, I mean, an ideological predisposition that is far more open to socialistic and socialism, I guess, policies.
Yeah, I mean, I think that if you look at the numbers now and the breakdown of political views by age. There's reason maybe for optimism, but weird things happen in history. I don't think that's a sure thing. I think we should remember that just in November, we saw this thesis about Hispanics and the great demographic transition there being something that would be really, really helpful for Democrats, really challenged in, I think, a significant way. So these different demographic groups, whether we're talking about young people or different racial groups, you know, anything that we see happening there is going to be fixed to this particular moment in time, and there's going to be a potential for change in the future. So I think there's reason to believe that the electorate is moving to the left. I don't know that we can see that shift, or that we can expect to see that shift continue at the same rate that's been happening now. I don't know that that precludes possibility that we could see a shift to the right for certain reasons. It's all kind of up in the air and amorphous right now. But I think that the real work we have to do has to be done without any kind of expectation that the work is going to be done for us by, you know, just time alone. In part because we don't really have a lot of time to solve the issues that we're facing as a country. You can think that there's going to be this demographic transition that gets us to comprising a majority of the Democratic electorate in the 2030s or the 2040s. And then we were going to elect a socialist candidate or whatever. Well, you know, on a climate timeline, that doesn't really matter. Like we have the time we're being given right now to address that problem. It's not going to help people who are struggling right now. So anything we can do to sort of accelerate the extent to which we have influence, I think is going to be really, really important.
So you talk about the project of conservatism after Goldwater's loss and how they basically expanded all their think tanks and their entire apparatus, you know, magazines, National Review gained prominence, other things like that. And a lot of that infrastructure remains to this day. And the roadblock that comes to mind is just that there's so much more money on the conservative side of things to build the kind of project that you're talking about to reach people in those specific ways. Whereas if there's money on the Democratic side, it's often to fund the exact tendencies that frustrate us, like the bipartisanship, the kind of empty promises that don't have staying power. What's your response to that, and what's your opinion of that dynamic?
Well, absolutely, conservatives have this sort of stable reserve of cash they can use for these kinds of projects. But I don't think people should discount the amount of money that people on the left have been able to sort of access and create for themselves over the past 10 years. Look at the Bernie Sanders campaign. Look at all of the small dollar donations and what they were able to do. It's just a matter of spending that kind of money wisely, making sure that we're not dumping $100 million to try to elect Amy McGrath, you know, or something. It's making sure that all the resources we do have are being used in creative ways, ways that we think are going to be, you know, to put a crack in the firmament of things and not sort of dumping it down the tube. That would be a good place to start. But yeah, it's true the conservatives have a lot of money. But I don't think that that is something that we should see as an insurmountable challenge for us.
We need to give more money to the Lincoln Project.
To achieve.
I mean, you know, like that's a fine example of like money that, and I appreciate that people out there, you know, I'm happy to have people criticize Donald Trump, but to fund them to that level is not going to get you to the place that you want to be if you are looking for some type of legislative action by Democrats that is, you know, more akin to what FDR would do rather than, let's say, Mitt Romney would have done. But with that said, to what extent, and I want to circle back. Well, let me just follow on this. The other thing that fueled this, this rise, and certainly it's, I think it's, you know, one of the sort of like, I don't know, one of the stories obscured by Donald Trump on some level, but also brought into relief with Donald Trump, is the self-identified Christian right in this country. I mean, you can call it a bunch of other things. And its relationship, frankly, to both authoritarianism and an authoritarianism that came out of the South. I mean, there's, you know, it's not the Venn diagram of the self-identified evangelical Christian. That circle and the circle of authoritarianism that, you know, has been studied in this country. 25% of North Americans are considered to be authoritarians. And that that last circle of, you know, states that seceded from the Union. That Venn diagram is, you know, it's pretty shaded, let's put it that way. I mean, there's a little bit on the margins.
It's a circle.
But, I mean, where does that exist on the left? I mean, there is no cohesion like that. I mean, you can take 65% of those people fall within that. There's nothing like that in the Democratic coalition, is there?
I don't really think so. Conservatism has always been, I mean, it's been internally contradictory if you look at the ideology, but there's been institutions that kind of bind people together, and the Christian right, obviously, and the churches have been a big part of that. Now we have churches, obviously, as well. The Black church is going to be a huge part of Democratic politics, I think, well into the future. But you're right that there's not really much of a binding agent for all of the different constituencies within the Democratic coalition. Beyond, I think, now, just sort of the fear of what happens if Republicans take over. Okay, we disagree about X, Y, and Z. We're not very alike in a lot of ways, but look, like, the Republican control, or I guess in this presidency, Donald Trump is such a threat that we all have to come together, set that aside, and, you know, operate as a unit. When it comes to actually doing constructive policy, that's a problem, right? Because you're not being animated by a specific, you know, total kind of vision that everybody shares for the way the country has to go. I think that you saw the Bernie Sanders campaign, and really him as a political figure, that all of that was kind of an effort to create this, to tell a story about the American economy, who has power and who doesn't. Everybody can relate to, everybody could understand it's true, and that would be, you know, a binding kind of force. Obama was good at this sort of civic nationalism, this kind of telling a story about America that everybody can see themselves in. And that was kind of a binding agent. And Biden is trying to do the same thing, but I think the problems are so deep, and people understand now that they're so deep, that I don't know if you can do that in a really, really compelling way. He's certainly not as gifted as an orator as Obama was. He's not as gifted as a communicator. So we'll see, you know, now over the course of this presidency, how well he's able to succeed in resurrecting that bond. But, you know, whether or not he does, I think it's up to the left now to sort of, again, present a different kind of narrative, to present a story that everybody within the coalition can sort of see themselves within and understand as true and use as an animating force for our political objectives.
Substantively speaking, I think the real question is going to be, you know, to what extent did Biden, as a member of the Obama administration, I mean, I think like this is, and I should say, you know, I'll preface it by saying there's certain limitations as to what we can expect. And I think, you know, you certainly have read, I mean, I should say written, or I've read of yours, that, you know, it would be a mistake for the left to have certain expectations of Biden in terms of, you know, who he's going to put into his cabinet and what he's going to do, and not to be mistaken for not to have demands, but, you know, also don't kid yourself. The real question in terms of what he's going to be able to provide to the left and how far the left is going to be able to push him in this country is going to be, it seems to me, a function as a completely purely practical political consideration. To what extent are they going to make the same mistakes that they claim that they made under the Obama administration, which was to misinterpret to assume that Republicans were operating in good faith. It's still unclear to me. I think we'll know in a couple, you know, just after this, the whole $1.9 trillion coronavirus relief bill, how savvy they are to what they can really expect from Republicans. And so going forward. But let me, with that said, you touched on this about third parties, and I'm curious as to your perspective, because there is, and this is sort of, this is sort of narrow, but we're talking about the left in this regard, and about, you know, the 10 majority reports that are out there. There is a sort of a nascent sections of the you know, to a large extent, the online left. But if we're talking about communications, we have to recognize that, you know, Twitter may not be real life, but it is real life, A, and B, a lot of media people are on there. And so it shapes some narratives. There is, like, on the online, certain corners of this the online, you know, arguably left, there are attacks on like the Squad and the Justice Democrats as being insufficiently committed to, I don't know, certain strategic or tactical maneuvers. Like, give me your take on that.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I don't think it's wrong to try to, you know, hold people in Congress accountable, whether they're, you know, people who've declared themselves as socialists or people who are sort of ordinary Democrats. I think it makes sense to hold everybody's feet to the fire and make sure that they're keeping the promises they've made. That's not really an issue for me. I do sort of wonder how useful it is to try to, you know, psychoanalyze these people and do this kind of critique where you're always assuming that there is some kind of ulterior motive in the background that's pulling, you know, puppeteering everything that you're seeing happen. I think that people in the Squad are better in most respects or in every respect than the average Democratic member of Congress. But, you know, I think that there's going to be places over the course of the next few years where there are going to be legitimate critiques to be made of those people. And there are going to be questions that we're going to have to ask. I just think that we should be sane and not, you know, veer into a kind of emotionality about who they are and what they're doing. That would be my only take. I don't think it's wrong to criticize AOC or to say AOC should be doing this or that, but, you know.
What do you think about, I mean, just, I guess, this phenomena of like, of misinformation and of the tendency of, I mean, I think that type of critique and that analysis is a function of, you know, the nature of shows like mine on some level, which are, you know, some hybrid between, you know, what we see as television news and like talk radio on some level where, and, you know, some of the worst stuff that we have in this country has come from talk radio. It is good, but I mean, some of the worst tendencies that we have are born of this medium. Where do you think all that goes? And how do we deal with that from a just sort of a purely from having a like a sort of a functioning democracy?
Yeah, I just think it's important for us not to be too insular. Going back to what I was talking about before, I mean, one of the reasons why talk radio and things that resemble talk radio can be bad is that you're a group of people who are like each other, talking to each other all the time, and not talking to anybody sort of outside of the bubble and sort of losing your ability to communicate with a person who is not, let's say, on Twitter 18 hours a day. You know, that is where a lot of the neuroses set in. So I think it's important, again, to develop channels of communication that will allow us to talk to people who are not already in our camp and people who are not really into politics even. I think that's the healthiest way to go about things. A conversation with a normal person who has not been on Twitter, I think I have found to be a very sort of restorative mental practice for myself personally, I think would probably be good for the movement as a whole.
What do you think we can expect in terms of like, how do you think this is going to play out with Biden's relief package?
Well, it's interesting because I think that what we've seen in the proposal so far is a lot of things that can be done through budget reconciliation, which is a process, a little complicated, but it's a process where you can bypass the filibuster to pass certain kinds of bills that are spending related. A lot of what we saw in the package that Biden proposed can be done through that. But at least one very big thing cannot, and that's the $15 minimum wage. That is something that you have to pass through the conventional legislative process because it's not a spending provision.
Has that been established yet? Because I've seen it go both ways. I mean, mm-hmm. I think we need, I think literally this is one of those things where the parliamentarian of the Senate has to make a ruling on this, right? Because the argument that it might drive revenue, but that it may drive revenue, which impacts the budget, but that it's incidental. It really, I mean, my understanding is it's almost a function of, and this is how I think that, like, you know, it's hard for people to sort of to grok on some level. who gets appointed to the Congressional Budget Office and how they decide to score the implications of the $15 minimum wage, which is ostensibly a nonpartisan position, the CBO is, but just their perspective on what numbers are important could impact that outcome as to whether it can be part of reconciliation or not.
It could. I mean, it's dicey because the Byrd rule, which is the thing that governs reconciliation, is not just a Senate rule. It's actually like embedded within the law in some respects, and it gets complicated. I think that the thing to sort of hold is a guiding principle, though, I think, in these kinds of conversations, is that although Democrats should take whatever opportunity is given to them to stretch the rules and push as much through that they can, you don't want to be in a situation where the $15 minimum wage is actually illegal, right? This is something that can be struck down with a lawsuit or some kind of intervention by Republicans, right? You want it to be done as in a way that is unchallengeable as possible. That goes for all the things that Democrats are going to hope that they accomplish over the course of Biden's term. So we'll see. We'll see. I think that there's going to be a moment of truth on the filibuster probably fairly soon, whether it's a $15 minimum wage or something else. And it'll be incumbent upon progressives, activists, to sort of make it clear to the party, not because they hope it's going to change, and undergo this big ideological transformation, but to make clear to the party that if you want to be reelected in 2022, if you want to hold your seat wherever you are in your next election, it's going to be extremely important that you vote to eliminate this procedural rule. You bring the Senate to a more democratic place, and you allow the democratic agenda to move forward. That's the big task.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's I guess it's going to come down to that. And I think on some level, we're also going to get a sense of whether Biden is if this nod to bipartisanship is a head fake or just a bluff call, essentially.
Well, that's my question then, is what's your sense of, because Biden is actually seemingly responding to some of that progressive pressure with cabinet appointments that weren't handpicked by Citigroup, for example, when we're talking about the Obama era. And this $1.9 trillion proposal, it does seem to contain some progressive elements. So where do you see that going? Do you see him towing this line? Or are you more optimistic that he's responding to the growing pressure that we've talked about that's like changed in terms of the Democratic base over the past decade or so?
I think that he's been responsive to left pressure and will continue to be responsive to left pressure. The thing is that he's also going to face right pressure, and he's going to respond to that as well, especially once Trump is out as the big bad and Democrats come in, and maybe, once we've passed the coronavirus bill, there's going to be, a lot of pressure from the usual suspects to say, well, okay, you've just spent however many trillion, however much the final package ends up being. Now we have to kind of dial things back. We've given people a lot of money. Let's not let people get used to the idea of the government regularly handing out checks to people who are in need. We can't sustain that. That's, the debt is becoming unsustainable. You saw Hugh Hewitt, I think, today, try to put this line out there. But there's going to be more of that, much more of that. Right. And I think we're going to be in a place where the policy discussions we're having are going to resemble the policy discussions that we had under Obama in a lot of respects. And so I think it's going to be up to progressives and activists to make sure that the movement or whatever it is, whatever we want to call it, the responsiveness doesn't end within the next couple of months, and we don't go home.
I mean, it's going to be fascinating. On some level, I wish we could jettison 25 years into the future and look back on this moment just from the perspective, I would interview a professor from I don't know what university it would be, and they would come on. They've written a book on the very question as to whether the deficit hysteria comes back right now, because that's going to be a huge tell about our political society, it seems to me. This was such a monumental pillar of the Republican Party's over the past, rhetoric over the past 25 years. And in fact, we had an interview yesterday that in some ways indicated it was also part of post-Reconstruction. But this idea of a deficit, if it can make a comeback and it's taken seriously by our political, our political journalistic class, it's going to be astonishing. I mean, they jettisoned this so far into the ether, like it was, and the idea that it could come back and just be welcomed as if it had never gone away is going to be fascinating, it seems to me.
Yeah, I agree. And I wouldn't be surprised if it did, honestly. I think that the conditions are kind of right for it, especially if Trump has been eliminated as this kind of, people saw him as a heterodox figure. I think I was always overstated. But if it's true that you know, the Republican Party goes through what liberals on television sort of hope for, you know, excising Trumpism, all the people who are going to be left are kind of as in positions of influence, or, you know, who are going to return to positions of influence, are people with very conventional Republican takes on the deficit, on spending, on, you know, all the questions are going to be facing us over the next couple of years. You know, Mitt Romney, if he becomes a person that people turn to for more and more takes and perspectives on American politics, he's going to put out there the same kinds of lines we heard about deficits and spending that we heard under Obama. So, you know, I wouldn't be surprised at all if we see a return to deficit hysteria and that kind of politics. I think that it'll be very easy for people to say, well, the coronavirus is this extraordinary situation. We've never faced anything like it. But now, you know, let's say 2022 or 2023, we're through that, and we need to return to economic principles that we hope persist in normal conditions. You know, I think that could happen very well.
Well, I hope people can will have the ability to remember like 2017 and 2018.
That's asking a lot. We're a short memory country.
Hope springs eternal. Sita Wanavu, writer at the New Republic, thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate it. We're going to link to your pieces over there. Folks should really check out the stuff you've been writing. It's
One of the best writers out there right now, I would say.
Thank
Love
you, Sita.
Thank you very much for having me.
We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back to wrap things up.
Mute Sam.
Sorry about that. We're back. One of the things that I think that we're seeing as this plays out, as we're getting more information, and you have now federal prosecutors claiming that in a court filing that there were members of this mob who were interested in kidnapping and assassinating our lawmakers, that the vice president was, I guess, 10
Within
seconds away
seconds from being in eyesight of the insurrectionists who were just walking up. He was ushered into a hallway, and they were right there, that close.
Here is a clip. It's from CNN of D.C. Metro police officer Michael Fanone, who is describing facing these violent rioters. And to be clear, you know, I mean, I think people can grok and understand the difference between any violence that we saw in the context of actual protests that took place over the summer. But this was, I mean, people showed up for this purpose here, which was to break into, I mean, you don't like, hey man, I'm here at this protest, I wish we had stuff to construct a gallows, right? Like, that's not That's not just a coincidence that they had material to construct a gallows.
Oh, they just came across a pile of gallows, a how-to kit?
Yeah, exactly.
They got it from Home Depot, or someone just dropped it off on their way.
I mean, let's be clear what was going on. Play this clip. It's really disturbing.
I was just, you know, trying to fight as best I could. I remember, like, guys were stripping me of my gear. These are rioters pulling my badge off my chest. They ripped my radio off of off my vest. Started pulling like ammunition magazines from their holder on my belt. And then some guys started getting a hold of my gun, and they were screaming out, you know, kill him with his own gun. At that point, you know, it was just like self-preservation. You know, how do I survive this situation? And I thought about, you know, using deadly force. I thought about shooting people. And then I just came to the conclusion that, you know, if I was to do that, you know, I might get a few, but I'm not going to take everybody, and they'll probably take my gun away from me, and that would definitely give them the justification that they were looking for to kill me if they already didn't have made that up in their minds. So the other option I thought of was, you know, try to appeal to somebody's humanity. And I just remember yelling out that I have kids, and it seemed to work. Some people in the crowd started to encircle me and try to offer me some level of protection. And they gave, you know, that provided me with like enough time, or other officers, specifically my partner, Jimmy Albright, enough time to get to me and get me the hell out of there and back into the west front of the Capitol. A lot of people have asked me, you know, my thoughts on the individuals in the crowd that, you know, that helped me or tried to offer some assistance. And I think kind of the conclusion I've come to is like, you know, thank you, but f*** you for being there.
Wow. Well, that's a guy who went through a fairly terrifying...
not much respect for cops in that crowd.
Yeah, very surprising turnaround. Very surprising turnaround. I mean, I still remember the days. I mean, I'm old enough to remember where it was an incredible inciting and violent attack on American values to take a knee during the national anthem. And now you're probably too young to remember that. That was a long time ago.
It's ancient history. I read about it in school, I think.
Yeah. Folks, that's it for us today. We will be back next week. In the meantime, we will see you then. For those of you sticking around on this casual Friday, we will see you now. There's a chance, Brendan. What's the status of our special guest today?
They're here.
You're here. Okay. Excellent. All right. Well, then I can actually introduce them. Right?
Should I admit them now, or?
Yeah, why not? We'll do it in the first half. Let's bring these guys on. Folks, we've had these guys on before, right? When was it? It was a long time ago. Maybe it was 4 years ago. Was it, guys? Brendan?
I think it was the primary. It was before Brendan, so it must have been the 2016 primaries.
They're still at it. Folks, we have the Good Liars on the program. Jason and Davram are here. Are they here? Can we bring them in?
Oh, I thought they were together.
They're connecting now.
This is good stuff, folks. Well, let's play a clip. Let's play a clip. Do you have the clip of the thing with Oh gosh. Here we go. Jason and Davram, Good Liars. Welcome, guys. Thanks for joining us.
Hey.
Thanks so much for having us.
So you've been at this now for 4.5 years. Did you guys ever leave the campaign trail?
Well, I don't think the campaign ever really ended for Donald Trump. So he just about a month into taking office, he kept campaigning. So we felt like we had to stay on the campaign trail the whole time too. So as our service, you know.
I'm trying to pull up the clip I saw today that I think it's a trailer for your movie, and I want to get into that. Oh, here it is. Let's see if I can get these guys to play it. Here we go. And I want you to just set the scene.
And not the Helen Mirren movie. Yes.
No.
That has been
although
the
I never got around existed. To seeing it, so if we've got to play it and watch it real quick.
There's an S on the end. Yeah.
So, do you guys? We're going to play this clip, and I want you guys to basically narrate it for us. It is. I take it that you're. Well, I can't tell. Are you mocking Rudy Giuliani in this clip? This is a clip where Dobrym, you came in as if you had just been hit by a bus or something, and Jason, you stand up in the middle of a campaign event and address the camera. I thought this was pretty impressive, just from a technical standpoint, at the very least. Here, play this clip.
Some examples of how
big it is. Listen 1 second. Tom Steyer hit me with his car in the parking lot. He ran over me, and I'm injured, and I don't know what to do. He ran over me with his car, and I'm injured.
Has this ever happened to you? You might be entitled to a large cash sum. Call me the Fixer Lawyer. Visit www.thefixerlawyer.com. And you won't pay unless you collect. Period. Ellipses. That sentence is not true.
So, I love how you were just waiting in the wings for
well,
your
the
moment.
Best part is, I mean, we just walk us through this, but Tom Steyer is sitting there. He is so completely flummoxed. I've never seen it like it. Just it is. Jason, just walk us through this, and then and you can add to it.
Well, actually, we got to this event probably like 3 minutes before we did the whole prank. And Tom Steyer was a pretty good sport about everything. And he was very, very confused. And then after this clip, I go up to him at where it ends. I go up and I'm like, hey, you're a billionaire. Let's make a deal. Just give my client $1 million and we'll call it a day here. And then one of his supporters actually gets up and tries to hit me in my groin region.
Oh.
Which I thought was very surprising at a Tom Steyer event, of all places.
Aggressive to go there first. Like, you'd think that's like.
Right, that's usually a last resort type of move.
Yeah, it's not an offensive move, usually, at least from what I've seen in pro wrestling. I don't really know the real world.
What was. From your perspective, I mean, one of the things I thought that was great about it was just this whole scene is playing out, and it's almost the fact that politicians on stage is almost incidental to what is going on.
Right. In our film that, you know, we're still working on, our characters, it might sound a little convoluted, but we have decided that the best way to get money to fund our trip across the country is to try and get a bunch of money from Tom Steyer. So we kind of placed these politicians in the narrative of the film. And this is one of the crazier ones, one of the harder ones to explain probably, but our characters really believe we're going to embezzle him out of $1 million right then and there. And it doesn't work out and we move on and we end up, you know, interacting with other candidates and people involved.
So give me a sense of like just the scope of the movie. Is it just during the Democratic primaries or what is the scope of it? Did you go to Trump rallies this time around?
We did. It actually, you know, it started in the, we had a film written and then COVID happened and we had to like, you know, we stopped shooting it and we were like, are we even going to do anything? It was supposed to take place all the way up into the election. And then around August, we were like, I think we can go out and shoot safely right now. at least not put other people in danger, because we were most of what we had to shoot was with Trump supporters. And so we went and we kept filming. And, you know, it is a work in progress right now where we were in the Capitol. So some of that might. And we weren't in the Capitol.
We weren't in the Capitol.
We didn't commit any federal crimes, but we were there witnessing what happened last week. So some of that is going to make it in whatever makes sense.
But to answer your question, the second half of the movie is when, you know, COVID hits and the primaries are over. And then the rest of it is kind of a little more about Trump and COVID and what's going on right now. So we kind of pivot after we interact with all these Democrats.
I want to hear a little bit more about that. And I also want to hear about how you were not in the Capitol. This is like an interview with Brandon Strzok.
Saying but, I am not a crook. Now everyone's going to think that they actually were.
I know. This is going to be like in the while I'm on the witness stand, they're going to play this clip.
Yeah.
Well, what did you mean right there?
This was a real gotcha, even though it wasn't supposed to be.
I was.
You've got a problem.
But let me just ask you, just like broadly in terms of your, I mean, the whole thing reminds me. I don't know if you guys ever saw Medium Cool and know Haskell Wexler. All right. Yep. The Haskell Wexler was this DP who ended up shooting a movie that intersected with the 1968 convention riots, just sort of coincidentally on some level. I mean, they knew that there was going to be stuff going down. They used their drama within a narrative within real life backdrop. But so, all right. So tell us more about what happened at the Capitol that you were not involved in.
Well, we went there to kind of talk to people. We knew, I guess, unlike law enforcement, that this was going to be a crazy event, maybe get out of hand. We just decided we wanted to interview people before and while, you know, Trump was speaking, to get a sense of the types of people who were here, were there. And then we thought this could get a little dicey. We should probably get out of town. And on our way out of town, we're passing this incredible crowd of people walking from where Trump had spoken to the Capitol. And we're like, there's no way he ordered them to the Capitol, right? That wasn't something we knew at that moment. We looked on Twitter and everyone's saying Trump just told, you know, this group of people, it's really, you know, this mob to head to the Capitol. We couldn't resist kind of going to just see what went down. So we kind of stayed at a safe distance. And it was like, really surreal. I'm sure that's a word being overused, but we were watching as they broke through in the place where they broke through, and we're at what feels like kind of a safe distance. You know, some guy runs by with his dog, like people were living their lives, but like 100 yards back from the total, you know, craziness that was unfolding.
Yeah.
And we watched them break through the line of police and then, you know, eventually fill up the stairs and get inside the Capitol.
It was really bizarre to because when we walked up to the Capitol, like to where the crowd was gathering, we walked past like 15 or 20 Capitol police who were on the road. And we could see that there was like a big crowd of people who were trying to go up the steps, the back entrance of the Capitol. And we were like, I could see from where we were that these guys should probably be over there and not here by the road. And then sure enough, after we were watching for about 5 minutes or 10 minutes, we saw the guys running up, like with their hands on their guns, screaming into their radios, like, where do you want us to go? Like the same guys who were just like leaning against the wall, like calm before, they were now running. And it was too late.
I don't know if you remember, we were walking up to it and this young guy, probably like 17 or so with a big Trump cowboy hat on, we said, what's going on over there? And he just goes, well, I don't know. It got a little crazy. Like, he had called it quits. He was walking the opposite direction. And so that was our first clue that like something was maybe going to happen. And, you know, at least for this one guy, it was too much. But when we got there, pretty much everyone was still arriving. And then it, you know, kind of broke open.
You say everyone, like how many people are we talking about? Do you have a sense of like, I mean, was there 10,000 people who went to the Capitol, or was there, I mean, how many people were at the rally and then how many people started to march down to the Capitol?
I think more than that, because what we saw the back entrance where we actually saw them like break through the police line and go up the steps of the Capitol. And then that, I think, from looking at the reports and like putting everything together, that's where the people originally went into the building. I would say from there, DeVron, maybe I'm totally wrong on this, but there was like 2,000 people back there, right?
Right. I think there were 2,000 or 3,000 people kind of back there. The concentration obviously was on those back steps. And then we walked around to the other side of the building, and I don't know if there were, you know, 8 to 10,000 more or something. Again, concentrated in the front of the building, but then it was just kind of fanning out. Some people were there watching, and then the you know, more excitable people were rushing into the crowd. And yeah, I don't know, people running away, you know, like injured, but then you'd see, you know, someone with kids walking up to it or something. It was like, you know, people praying.
That was the most surreal part, was we were watching it and there was a stage set up there with a Pentecostal evangelical, I'm not sure what kind of, what denomination of Christianity they were, but they were with it. They had speakers and they had a microphone and they were praying and speaking in tongues, being like, the blood of Jesus protect this building, the blood of Jesus protect Donald Trump, the blood of Jesus is on this building. And they're chanting and kneeling while these people are beating the hell out of cops.
And then a stretcher rolls by and like, you know, like I said, a guy running with his dog behind us, like he was on his daily run and he wasn't going to let this get in the way. And, you know, it's just the most bizarre cross section of things. And I think, you know, I don't know, just these people saying with the support they have had for the cops throughout all of everything that happened. And then I saw a cop, you know, in tears trying to call for backup from the ATF and, you know, couldn't believe it was going to be 30 minutes or whatever it was. And so, you know, these people were totally, totally overwhelmed.
Wow. So I want to get back to just the because you guys were on the campaign trail, and obviously you were focusing more on the Republicans during the primary, I would imagine, in 2016 versus the Democrats, or maybe you weren't, but I think you were. It may have flipped a little bit this time around. But to the extent that you guys were going to, like, Trump rallies in 2016, and then to the extent that you were going to any later, did you guys ever find yourself saying, like, hey, things are different? Or was it basically a consistent, like, nothing had changed?
I would say absolutely. Absolutely. Every single time we went to a Trump rally, it felt worse, I think I could say. The first one we went to was in January of 2016, and it was like in a country club place, you know, probably like 400 people there. There wasn't like a lot of anger, I would say, there. Then we went to another one in May or early June of 2016 in California. And you could, when you went inside the arena in, I think it was in Orange County somewhere, you could feel the heat from the anger from these people.
There were fights, but it was also like a weird party. There were like bottles of alcohol in the bathrooms. Like, it was like, what event is this outside, you know, riot police and clashing with protesters, and inside it was like a music festival mixed with like an angry political speech mixed with whatever Trump does when he, you know, just meanders and wanders with, you know, but people hanging on every word. It was like, this is, you know, it's building to something. But I think to speak to what happened this time around, I think it was even crazier because people really feel entitled to Trump being in power. Before it was like, can he win? And now he's in power and we don't want him to give it up. So I think there was even some entitlement that crept into the whole thing, the whole soup of whatever's going on.
And these people were at the Trump rally. We went to one in Georgia in December, beginning of December. And the talk, the violence was not at all surprising, I don't think, to either one of us. We didn't think they were going to storm the Capitol. But these people really believe that the election was stolen, and they really believe that Donald Trump is telling them to rise up in the same way of a civil war. Like, everyone was saying 1776, 1776.
Revolutionary War. And right.
They would say Civil War, but then right. they were saying 1776, like, this is our battle. This is like our Independence Day.
So, and not just generally speaking, oh, you've got to rise up and take this country back. But, you know, in the days before January 6th, it crystallized into January 6th is the day you rise up and take the country back, which I think obviously takes a dangerous situation and makes it even more volatile, like it did. It was today that this had to be done.
What about Q? Did you like you guys probably, you know, more than, you know, because I would imagine that you guys are as well situated as any sort of like political reporter in the country to have witnessed the rise of Q, like on the ground, as it were.
Yeah, we definitely noticed. We went, I think it was in July or August, we went to a Trump event in Old Forge, Pennsylvania, which was literally just his motorcade driving by, and there was thousands of people on the side of the road. And we saw lots of QAnon signs and shirts, and we talked to some people. But now what you see is all of these QAnon conspiracy theories are the mainstream. It is the mainstream. The things that Sidney Powell and Donald Trump were talking about are the mainstream. Those are the conspiracy theories that the president is talking about, that he believes this is what happened in the 2020 election. They come from the message boards, and they literally come from these conspiracy theorists. So the growth was scary, because it used to be like, we would talk to some people that didn't know who QAnon was. When people would come up to us, a couple of people came up to us and just like grabbed the microphone and were like, well, we go one, we go all last week. So it was scary. And that is a point in our movie. We do reveal who QAnon is in the movie. It's part of our story, but.
Don't spoil that, for God's sake. But I guess what I'm curious about is like, could you guys track it? Like, I mean, how, like at one point, I mean, it feels like it's an hour. I mean, a year on both ends of that presidency that you guys were going to these rallies, at least maybe once some in between. But like, could you say like, wow, you know, when we 3 years ago or something, no Q people were at the beginning of this, you know, 10%. And now it's like 85%. I mean, was it that clear in terms of its growth?
A couple of years ago, we were talking about it like, you know, should we do something involving Q? And it was like, what is this again? We got to look into this so we know enough to talk to other people about it. That was only 2 years ago. And now I would say the majority of people, if you go to these events, know of Q. And I don't know, 20-30% are like psyched if you bring it up. So I think that's a total change. And that was 2 years ago.
But how many people, I feel like there's so many Trump supporters who have this very amorphous view of what Q is. Like, it means one thing to one person and another thing to another. Like, the general overview is that it's some person leaking information from within the deep state about Trump. But, I mean, is it all about pedophilia? Is that really what it comes down to when you get into the nitty gritty of it with Trump supporters?
I think that's how a lot of people got red-pilled and got like put onto Q, is through the Save the Children stuff that you'll see on Facebook. And it's like, we need to save the children. There's, you know, child sex trafficking going on. And of course, anybody who hears that is like, that's bad. I don't want that to happen. And then they get radicalized when they're like, it turns from that to like, and it's also this like global cabal of pedophiles who control everything and drink children's blood. That is literally the conspiracy, that you go from like something very reasonable to something that is completely insane. But people can be radicalized in a week, which is crazy, through these YouTube videos and stuff.
And once you believe that, where's the barrier to anything else? So saying the election was stolen and talking to all these people who believe the same thing, I don't think is a stretch at all. So I feel like it ended up being like this catch-all for whatever you want to say and try and spread, you know, the Q crowd is going to be open to it.
But the thing I think is that's scariest about it is that now we've talked to some people that believe the conspiracy theories but don't know who Q is. So these conspiracy things, the are going into the mainstream of like Republican thinking. And, but it's not this, there's no head to the snake. It's no longer Donald Trump. It's no longer that Q is working with Donald Trump and they're figuring all this out. It's like, no, there's this conspiracy. There is this Illuminati type of thing that is controlling everything. And we have to fight them. And it's not Donald Trump anymore. In a lot of ways, that's even scarier. Like, it's scary to have a cult of personality, but it's also scary that like somebody online on a random message board is like controlling heavily armed people in the country.
Wait a second. So if I understand you correctly, these conspiracies have now become untethered from even the origination, the origin story. It's no longer about Q. It's just about these sort of like second order conspiracies.
Yes. But I don't think there's been a Q drop in over a month right now, I think.
Anybody can be Q. Like, I mean, right? Like, I could go on and pretend to be Q. Or you guys actually know who Q is, so I
should. No, well, or it's JFK Jr., which is the big popular one, that it's actually JFK Jr.
That's right.
But it's the guy, I mean, isn't it the guy from New Jersey? I mean, the crazy thing is that the person, whoever it is, if the FBI knows who it is, they should be arrested for impersonating a government, you know, a military person online and whatever. And now that's basically like, because of things they've said, they have incited violence. So it's crazy that they haven't been arrested.
How cute. And
you guys might want to be careful about impersonating.
I know.
Impersonate people. I don't know if you know what you've been up to.
We're just catching up on what we've been up to.
Yeah, I know.
It's a little scary.
No, it's just like the Q people got all their validation they needed from the Epstein story. And it's like, that's that kernel that has just completely spiraled into, now we're going to attack the Capitol and five people are going to die. Like,
right. And building on Jason's point, I mean, some people still idolize Trump, but some people would say, you know, Trump is the vessel, but this isn't about Trump anymore. This is about taking our country back. And that, you know, it takes on another level of scary. And when Trump reads from a teleprompter, like he did the other day, I think these people are like, he doesn't really mean that. We're good. We know what our mission is. And that's scary.
Has something over him, even though he's this ultimate alpha that also is standing up to the deep state.
That sort of dynamic is something that like Limbaugh has been training a lot of those people to sort of accept is like, they have to say this. And that's also you get with white supremacists too, where they say like, yeah, he had to go on and say he didn't mean, you know, that white supremacists are good. He had to say it. Of course.
But if you wait a week to say it, they're like, he's with us. That's okay.
Let me ask you this lastly, because I'm fascinated about the Q folk. Did you have any sense of like what the relationship was between Q, you know, people involved in this Q stuff and religion? Because
that's so funny. I was just about to say that. The more I look at the QAnon stuff and after talking to people, there is a tie-in with religion. And I don't think you should look at it like you're trying to change someone's political belief. You should look at it like you're trying to get somebody out of a cult. or you should look at the way they believe in Q in the same way that somebody believes in God, because that is what that's taken that part in their life. And a lot of it is faith, literal faith, because it's like a doomsday cult. He keeps making predictions. They keep not coming true. And then they double down, because that happens throughout history. People, the prediction doesn't come true. And guess what? The leader of the cult gets more followers. They become more fanatical about it.
And having faith in the face of facts becomes almost like a badge of honor. It's like, I'm here till the end.
But it is Christian too.
Like religion.
It is a lot of the people that we talk to, they'll say like, they love QAnon. And they're also like, but I give all glory to Jesus Christ, our Lord and Savior, in the same breath.
Well, and the Save the Children thing also ties in too. It's like that same, you know, abortion fanaticism as well.
Absolutely.
A modality of thought. Once you have trained your brain to believe that there is a figure who is sending messages from high above that you can't see and can't identify, and you just need to trust in them, and everything's going to work out all right. Once you've trained yourself to sort of like structure your life around that, then it's just a question of who you're sliding in and out of that role at any given time, I think.
Right, right. So it's going to be interesting to see what happens with Trump out of power with all these people and how the QAnon, like if there's any more Q drops or if somebody else comes in, like how the fantasy, the live action role playing continues for these people.
All right. So when is the movie coming out, A, or being finished? And then B, I'm curious as to like, what are you going to do now?
We were just talking earlier today about that. It's like, oh, Trump's out of office. What are you going to do? It's like, things are more messed up now than they've ever been. And the crazy part is that it's not Trump. It's not this just big, bad boogeyman. Like, we've got a lot of stuff to figure out as a country, and hopefully we can do that in a funny way. But like, the craziness has not stopped because of Trump. It is not as, you know, centered on one person, but there's still craziness.
So are you guys just like looking to see who the person's going to sort of like rise out of the ashes for this? Or are you going to continue to follow Trump? Or are you not even thinking about that? You just finish this up and then we'll.
Well, for the movie, you know, you can get a sneak peek of it on our Patreon right now if you want to see some parts of it and a rough put together of some of the stuff of it. But that's kind of evolving with what's happening and how it's going to end. Looking at some of the footage we have, we're going to figure that out for that project. But then for us, we're just going to go where the wind blows us
will emerge as they always do. It's hard to predict, but then as things unfold, it becomes very clear when we are like, oh, we got to go there. Talk to those people.
Well, Jason Davram, the Good Liars, folks can find you guys at the Good Liars on Twitter, and your Patreon is what?
Patreon.com/TheGoodLiars.
Right, Patreon.com/TheGoodLiars. Thanks so much for coming on, guys. Really
Thanks, guys.
Enjoy your work.
Thank you.
All right, folks. I guess we're going to head to the fun half.
I guess so.
Yeah, we'll take some phone calls, maybe. I don't know. Fridays are always tricky, but we will definitely take some IMs. And just a reminder, it is your support that makes the show possible. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. Jointhemajorityreport.com. You support the free show, and then you get extra content every day. Oh, and check this out. Brendan, pull up Matt, pull up shop.majorityreportradio.com. Let's show people the new swag. Okay.
Wow.
There's that. The long sleeve, left is best t-shirt with a huge committee. We finally decided to do the logo on the arm. You can see left is best right in front there. There it is.
I like that decision.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was going to be on the cuff. We weren't sure. All right. Go back. Oh, yeah. There you go. Decorated in a decorated. Is that what it says?
Yeah.
Why don't you say printed?
Sam, you don't want to mess with these. They're, you know, the union rules. So,
all right, decorated in Union Shop. This is American made, U.S. made, and Union made. Here is the gray Whispering Sam beanie. And what's the Whispering Sam part? Oh, that right there? They didn't put. You can't
right see. Over their ear.
You can't see the. Oh, I see. So I'm whispering into.
Yeah, but
your
from
ear.
But from the side, you can see the whole face.
Yeah, but yeah, we can't see that part. Well, I don't know if I would have done it that way, but that's all right. That beanie is great. And then look down here, though. There's another beanie. Wait, where's the black beanie? Don't we also have a black beanie without the Whispering Sam? I guess not. We really got it together, the merch division. But there it is, shop.majorityreportradio.com. Also, amquickie.com. 7 minutes of headline news in the morning. You can check it out. Tune in to Nomi's show today. If you go to youtube.com, the Noma Key show. And I don't know who's on today, but check it out. 3 p.m. youtube.com/TheNomaKey Show. Check out twitch.tv, The Antifada. Jamie and crew are streaming on twitch.tv like 3 or 4 times a week now. On Nomi's show, Simone Baptiste, Esperanza Fonseca, and maybe Natalie Scherr will be on Nomi's show. Check that out. Don't forget The Antifada. And Matt, what's happening on in the Matt Leck media universe?
Yeah, check out last night's episode of Left Reckoning on YouTube with Daniel Bessner. We went deep into his foreign policy and what to expect from that. So patreon.com/leftreckoning. We also did a post game last night.
Nice. You sound great, Matt, today.
It cleared up basically early evening.
There we go.
What's that, the internet?
Yeah, well, I couldn't hear Matt yesterday. It was sad.
Very frustrating. All right, folks. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
We're in for it.
All right, folks. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half. Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. Back, 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 back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back, back.
Just as delicious as you can imagine.
The alpha males are back, 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 back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back, 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 back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back, back.
I take all of it in my throat.
Alpha males are back.
Almost says what?
The alpha males are back, 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 back.
You are a madman!
And the alpha males are back, back, back.
I am a total cunt.
Can we bring back DJ Danner Key song, please?
Yeah, or a couple of them. Just put them in rotation.
DJ Danner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough of a break.
That's fucking nonsense.
Hey, fuck! Reminder!
I do not have Parkinson's.
And the alpha males are
psych. Fuck them. Fuck them.
Almost says what?
What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What?
Almost says what?
Hell out of the bank. Hell out of the bank. Hell out of the bank. Hell out of the bank.
All lives matter. Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black. African. And the alpha males are back, back, back. And the Africans are black, 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 black.
You see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keeping it 100.
Can't knock the hustle.
Come on! Fuck them, fuck them, fuck them, fuck them, fuck them, fuck them.
Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday!
My birthday!
Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black.
Come on! What? Come on! What? Come on!
Someone needs to pay the price for blasphemy around here.
I am in total
pussy, total, 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 pussy.